Welcome back to the RBR Recap, episode 31. I am Alex Burgos, joined as always by my man, Gabe Brevis. It's been a while, but we're back in action. Gabe, how are you, sir?
Good. I'm happy to be back. Yesterday was a little exhausting because there were so many cards, but I'm ready to talk boxing today.
For sure. I know we were talking off camera. It took us back to our early RBR days when we used to recap like 30 fights. We used to do every undercard, everything. Yep. It was very reminiscent of that, and you were working hard, and it's good to get back into action and back in the podcast on a weekend like this, because we had a lot of exciting fights. Obviously, the Mayer and Baumgartner fight and the Shields and Marshall fight were rescheduled or postponed because of the passing of the Queen, and so it got tacked on to this weekend. That was already a busy one Saturday with Haney and Kambosos, which we'll talk about, and then the return of the Bronze Bomber Deontay Wilder, and also entertaining co-main that could have been, you know, its own main event as well, and Caleb Plant and Anthony Durrell, high stakes at 168, for kind of stepping up to that next spot in the top contender realm at 168. And so we're going to start with another fight that could have been its own main event as well, on a historic female card in Alicia Baumgartner and Michaela Mayer. And it was probably one of the ones that I was most looking forward to, just because how these women handled the buildup. I mean, when you think about how you promote a fight, this is how you do it. And I think Tim Bradley, I thought was wrong on this account, that he was like, well, I thought as much as they talked, they were going to come out guns a-blazing and this and that. Like, no, it was a high-level boxing match. I thought it was super entertaining. And for all that it was, I'd love to see it again. Let's jump right into that one. Michaela Mayer, coming in undefeated at 17-0, five knockouts, took on Alicia Baumgartner, who was coming in at 12-1 with seven knockouts, both bringing titles to the plate. WBC title held by Baumgartner, WBO, IBF, and Ring Magazine junior lightweight titles held by Mayer. And I think it was a stellar performance. It had ebb and flows, and it was razor thin. And so I want to kick it to you first, just to ask you, and then I'll chime in with my two cents. But how did you see Mayer versus Baumgartner? Do you think the right fighter won? And what are your thoughts on the performance of each?
It was a historic night for women's boxing. And, you know, real quickly, I think it doesn't matter whether it's women's boxing or men's boxing. What we want are the elements that make for an exciting fight. And that's a heated rivalry and a competitive fight between two of the top fighters in the division. And that's what we saw with Baumgartner and Mayer. I do think the right person won. I don't think that Mayer landed enough punches throughout the fight. And I think that Baumgartner was very intelligent, especially in the earlier rounds when Michaela would come forward. She would come over the top with right hands, come over to the side with left hooks. I was kind of surprised with how easy it was for Alicia to land counter punches and then control the action with her footwork in those earlier rounds. It seemed like Michaela Mayer was getting frustrated. When she would throw more, she'd have more success, but she didn't do that enough times. And so I think that the right person won in Alicia Baumgartner, and credit to her. That was the third time she had traveled to the UK in order to fight. The first time was to knock somebody out and win the world title. She went again to make a defense. And then this third time, she became a unified champion. And I mean, all the credit goes to her. It's not easy traveling to a foreign country to not only win titles, but to defend them and then unify them. So she deserves all the credit in the world. And it was razor thin. It's not like Mayer looked completely terrible. It did show that she has some things to work on, especially when she cuts distance, because it seemed a little awkward in the first round. She kind of gets caught a little easier when trying to cut the distance, because she's so tall and her opponents happen to be usually happen to be shorter. I did see that she made some adjustments in a later round. She was kind of pairing with her jab and making sure she avoid those counters. But I think Baumgartner just really started to, I think Baumgartner won a lot of the early rounds based on those counter punches. And so it was hard for Michaela Mayer to get back on track after Alicia had gotten such a lead.
Yeah, definitely. I thought it was razor thin, like I said. I, on the other hand, scored it 6-4 for Mayer. I could have seen, obviously, Baumgartner winning. That's a fair decision. And I could have seen a draw as well. What I don't like is the narrative that people are spinning online that is a robbery. I think either fighter could have won. And it's unfortunate, because before the fight, you know, each one was like, I win this, I'm going after Choi. I'm trying to be undisputed. So that was always the plan. So if Mayer wins, you know, she's singing the same song that Baumgartner's singing now, which is like, nah, I'm not giving her a rematch. Yeah, she's not getting a rematch. Like, for what? And I understand it. And she's in her right to do so. Now, can this potentially be a big, you know, fight, a rematch down the road? Yeah, for sure. So let's see what Mayer does in the time, you know, that Baumgartner is going to go after Choi and try to, you know, potentially unify and or become undisputed. So let's say she does that. Maybe Mayer goes up, grabs a title or something else that makes this appealing again for, you know, promoters and such, and for the fans to still want to get behind this fight and want to see it again. I personally do want to see it, but again, I do understand that, you know, there are things, business at hand for each one, and it's just, it doesn't necessitate an immediate rematch. Like, I think it's different than maybe the Taylor Serrano. I thought that one would have been cool to see an immediate rematch. It was such a high stake, such a big fight. Now, obviously, there's ins and outs in that one as well, but it's not like this one where we already knew there's still that other belt out there that the you know fighters want to go after. So I thought in terms of the fight, Baumgartner, I thought she took the first two rounds. I gave Mayer the next three. And then after that, it was kind of ebb and flow. You could have gone like either way with some of these rounds. And so that's why I understand, you know, maybe a punch here, a punch there, that maybe grabs your attention and catches your eye and gives you that person the round. What I don't like, and I could have swore I saw this somewhere, that UK judges are encouraged to give 10-10 rounds. And if you see two of the cards are 96-95, so you start to think like, how did you get in a 10-round fight 96-95 twice? So obviously there's some 10-10 rounds there. It kind of takes the onus off the judge. It's like, okay, well, it was such a close round and they didn't want to give it to either person. So let's just like throw in a 10-10 to make it even and kind of, you know, because sometimes the ones that are super close, they end up going in opposite directions. So then you're thinking, well, how did Judge A get 97-93 and Judge B got 97-93, but for the other fighter? Well, sometimes it's those close rounds. I'd much rather see that than a bunch of 10-10s just because you're like, eh, I don't want to put my name out there as the one that gave, you know, this person the round versus the other. So I don't know what you think about that and if that's even a thing, but I think, in my opinion, judges should be encouraged to make a definitive answer, you know, versus just go towards a 10-10 round. And obviously, like, if two of them are doing it, it's something that's already at the forefront of their minds when they're judging.
Right. Well, the point of the must system is that in each round, the judge must pick a winner of the round, right? But at the same time, there's so much controversy. They get so much backlash, at least in the United States, when there's a bad judgment or a bad call, that I wouldn't blame them at all for saying, fuck it, I'm not taking the heat on this one. 10-10, right. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's tough because, like you said, they're the ones getting the backlash and they're the ones, you know, getting their names dragged in the mud. But I don't know. I'd like to see, you know, but then on the flip side too. Okay. Assuming the 10-10s are fair, I thought Mayer left the fight on the table, you know, for her to complain and say, I mean, she left the 10th, you know, the early round, she was a slow starter. So there are spots, like you said, that she could have improved on, things she could have done better, technically speaking as well. I thought she was a very hesitant but calculated fighter as well. So it wasn't like the Hamadouche Mayer, you know, it wasn't this, you know, other fighter that we've seen in the past. Now, obviously Baumgartner is a different fighter, but you know, we've seen Mayer be able to adjust and adapt to different styles of fighters. I thought early on she was tentative and that was maybe some of the issues that caused her to maybe go down on points.
Maybe she also felt Baumgartner's power with those counters early. She must have said, you know, I better be careful in exchanging with her because she could really crack.
Yeah, and she did get caught early, so she could tell us better than anyone, you know, can Baumgartner hit? And actually, speaking of power, we can transition now into the main event, Clarissa Shields versus Savannah Marshall, which, again, super excited about this fight just because of the buildup, you know, the tension, the animosity that was very real between the two. Obviously, the amateur story, Marshall being the only fighter to ever hand Shields a loss, and that was in the amateur. Shields has obviously gone on to have a historic run in the pros and was gunning for a third undisputed run, this at middleweight. She just needed to take the WBO title off of Marshall. Both came in undefeated. And I say it's a good transition because, speaking of power, Shields said after the fight, you know, I knew I had to kind of be careful because I could feel her power. She could punch. So we know, and I mean, you don't see it often. We've seen these highlight reel knockouts from Marshall. So she does have power. Any other fighter would have gone down from some of these shots that she landed on Shields, but Shields ended up getting the victory by, I thought, a clear unanimous decision. The judges' scorecards on one of them had a, one of them had it a little bit closer, 96-94. And then two of them were 97-93 for Shields, which I thought that was about right, 7-3 in rounds. And I thought Shields was high energy. She kept her focus, winging a lot of power shots that found their home. And man, if she had a little bit more power, because she's always saying, you know, I have power too. Like, I think she's obviously a serviceable puncher, but, you know, she has a little bit more power. The precision and the accuracy with which she was landing against Marshall, man, she would have taken her out. And so I thought it was a very high level performance by Shields. And again, she shows why she's the quote, the greatest woman of all time. I think it's hard to now argue, especially, you know, you can always go the historical route and compare resumes, this and that, who did what, but obviously with her contemporaries, I mean, she's taken out and come in and swept the whole, you know, women's boxing game. So give me your thoughts. Yeah. On what you thought between Shields and Marshall.
She's setting records that it's going to be very difficult for other women in the sport to be able to achieve. But were you surprised with Marshall's height, the difference between height and size between Marshall and Shields?
So I didn't think of that as much as an issue going in, but then one of the last keys I think that Bradley and Ward were talking about as the telecast got started was that height. And we're going to have to see how Shields navigates it. But I thought she was smart enough to smother Marshall's punches, because Marshall is kind of one of these that's like, you know, winding up, and, you know, she's not
like
the fastest.
The Smith brothers. You know what I mean? She fights exactly. Just like the Smith brothers.
Exactly.
But for me, it was kind of shocking how much taller she was than Clarissa Shields. But that's probably perhaps Clarissa Shields knows how to sit down in her punches more, whereas Marshall's was kind of coming forward a little too tall, kind of like the Smith brothers, as we just mentioned, especially Liam and Callum. But I thought it was a beautiful performance by Clarissa Shields. Like you said, if she had just had a little bit more power, she would be able to knock out people like Savannah Marshall, but doesn't matter because she's talented, she's quick, and she's very accurate. It was clear from the very beginning that Marshall's plan was to put her up against the ropes, land power shots, wear her down, but Shields didn't allow herself to get worn down. And she almost landed everything that she threw. She threw every single punch with all of her force. You can tell that, whether it was hooks, right hands, and it was very easy for Marshall to eat those punches as she was coming forward, because there was not much defense on her end. But like you said, it was a clear victory for Shields. I didn't see that many rounds for Marshall. And again, when it comes to aggression, it has to be effective aggression. It's not that aggressive. It's not that effective if you're coming forward and you're eating three to land maybe one that's kind of grazing. You know what I mean? So I think it was Shields who was a lot more effective in terms of her offense. And as she said in the post-fight interview, I won a lot of the rounds and I won a lot of the action by throwing counter punches on the inside. And she did that a lot, especially, like you said, she's good at smothering. And part of the technique behind that is that you're not allowing the opponent to take advantage of the wingspan of their long arms. So you're staying really close. And then after you're smothering or before you're smothering, you can throw short shots, which is harder for a taller person to defend against once they're on the inside. So excellent performance by Shields, definitely technically superior. Marshall, I mean, I'm sure she's a power puncher, but we didn't see that last night because Shields was hitting her with everything and because it was a lot more difficult for Marshall to hit her.
Yeah, and kudos to Shields. I mean, she stayed in the pocket a lot of the fight. A lot of people thought that maybe she's going to jab her way and show her, you know, her athleticism and box more, but she felt like the need to maybe make an exclamation point and a stand just because where they fought as well. You know, she had to win these rounds emphatically and show that, you know, she was going to sit down on her punches and, you know, come and bring the pressure. So I thought that was impressive too. I think also, you know, now we look at, you know, some of the things that, you know, Marshall was able to do against other fighters. Again, when you're talking about class and things like that, you just see the difference. When you're like, man, why wasn't she able to do what she did against some of these other? Well, that's because Shields is just levels above everyone else. And so I thought Tim Bradley, again, I disagreed with something he said. He was, discussing the head movement Marshall did, which she does a lot of this coming in. and she does a lot of shifting, which is a high level, you know, tactic. You know, Roberta Duran's, Gennady Golovkin, they would do that effectively. They shift and then they get into position to hit you with either hand. I thought Marsha would shift and she wouldn't land anything. She would actually get caught in different, you know, positions. And so she's trying to switch stances. She's trying to shift. And, you know, those things may work against other fighters. She slips a punch maybe and then comes with her own power punch. But I thought Shields was just so much quicker, able to see those punches coming in and didn't let those tactics become effective against her.
Yeah, she would try to change angles when Shields was on the ropes. It's to throw body shots or whatever. So like, you know, like you mentioned, fighters like Triple G, but especially also Chocolatito. Chocolatito sometimes would change angles and throw punches to the body. She would try to do that against Shields, but Shields was smart and she would move her legs to get outside before she would land that punch after changing angles. I mean, a recent example is Bam Rodriguez versus Israel Gonzalez. I believe I got his name correctly. And that's what happens when you study your opponent. Someone like Israel, it looks like he studied Bam Rodriguez. He knows he likes to change angles by stepping to the right. And instead of allowing him to do that, what he would do is that he would make sure that he would step to the opposite direction as soon as Bam would do that, so that Bam couldn't throw those punches. And we saw that with Shields as well. Marshall will push her up against the ropes, try to shift her legs, try to change angles. And by the time she'd be finished, Shields would be out of there and Marshall couldn't land her punches.
Yeah. And actually back to the point that I don't know if I finished that point with Bradley, it's like, yeah, okay, she's doing high level stuff, but it's not effective and she's not able to land her punches. So it's like, yeah, great. You're doing these things, but they're not working. And so that's kind of more kudos to Shields. And I thought he was given credit where, you know, almost saying like, oh, she's, you know, gaining momentum or she's going to get points for doing this. No, not really. I mean, she tried it and it just didn't work. But again, there's levels to this. So, again, kudos to Shields. Now, looking forward, I mean, I don't even know what we can talk about because she's going to go to a whole other sport, PFL. You know, Shields just has the world. I mean, go to movies or something. Like, the world is at her feet. So, I mean,
it's like the end of a video game. Game over. You're done. What do you do next?
Yeah, you beat the boss. Yeah, I mean, it was like, this was like the bonus level. Because, again, Christina Hammer, remember how much that was built up? She was like in boxing before kind of Shields came in and it was Hammer. Again, Shields wipes her out, becomes undisputed. And then it's like, okay, now what? Then we had to give Marshall some time to build her profile up. And then again, you know, now it's the you know, part two of the video game. We beat that one too. Now what?
Yeah. We got to wait for the new edition to come out. Maybe someone who could be posed a challenge maybe develops within the next few years. But right now, I don't see anybody in or around her division beating Shields.
Yeah. And I think we mentioned this, maybe not even on this podcast, but just in talking a while ago. And I think I said that, you know, the person that beats Clarissa Shields is probably like a 13-year-old basketball player right now.
Right.
Or something. You know what I mean? Like, they're going to, because women's boxing and everything is just going to, you know, bump up so much. The profile of women's fighting is bumping up so much. And so, yeah, it's going to be
next generation.
Yeah, the next generation. And that just depends on Shields, if she's going to hang around. You know, like some fighters we see just hang around a little bit too much. I don't know if that's going to be Shields' intent to stick around in boxing for long. But, you know, I think that's the type of fighter that we may just see that kind of takes the world by storm. And, you know, maybe historically would have been a basketball player or would have been a soccer player or something like that. And just says, you know what, I want to try fighting. And just, you know, because of that, becomes this other, you know, I guess Shields level person or fighter. But again, these records, like you said, to agree with what you were saying, these records that she's setting, this is gonna be a long time before anyone else touches those.
Yeah, big shoes to fill.
Yep, for sure. Next up, we had more undisputed talk. We're gonna jump into Devin Haney versus George Kambosos, a rematch again that, you know, people may have been interested in seeing the first fight just because of everything that surrounded Kambosos' victory over Teofimo Lopez. And then Haney, you know, trying to prove himself, always being labeled that, you know, email champ. And it was a true undisputed battle. Now, unlike the Shields Marshall and the Mayer Baumgartner, I mean, I think we heard everything we needed to hear before the first fight. The way that that fight unfolded, like a wipeout for Haney, I don't know that anyone really thought that this was going to be much different. And, you know, at the end of the day, it wasn't. Devin Haney dominated once again. And, you know, good for Kambosos. He cashed in two big paychecks after, you know, his big victory over Lopez. And also after being a road warrior, you know, getting himself in position into, fighting and winning on these Matchroom cards abroad for him. And so he did the hard work. I don't think he was given anything. So I will say that he deserved these two fights. You know, they had the clause for the rematch. He got what he deserved. It's just that he's against a guy in Devin Haney that's just high level boxer, one of the best in the world. And yeah, 10 times out of 10, that's how this fight is going to go. Gabe, what were your thoughts on Haney's performance, Kambosos' performance, and what's next for them?
I'd be lying if I said that it was the most exciting fight in the world, or if that it was one of the most highly anticipated rematches in the world. I think that after the dominance that Haney demonstrated in the first fight, there was no doubt as to the result of this fight. However, Haney was more successful in landing the right hands. He mentioned in the post-fight interview that he expected Kambosos to be looking for Haney's jab. So this time he wanted to show other things in his arsenal. His dad asked him to throw the left hook, but what won him the fight was the right hand. And you saw that especially as the rounds progressed. Once Haney got comfortable, once Haney got his rhythm, he started landing his right hands more. And hopefully we see more of that in upcoming fights. We see him land his right hand more. We see more power shots because we've already seen that he can control a fight with a jab at a world championship level. But let's see you pick up the pace and throw some more power shots and make the fights exciting. With Kambosos, I don't, like you said, 10 out of 10 times, the result will be the same. He tried to do something different by moving erratically, switching the southpaw. But if you noticed, he would switch the southpaw, but he'd only throw the punches from the orthodox stance. And I think Haney picked up on that really quickly. And Haney was really smart. Those early rounds, kept his eyes open, used his left hand, used his footwork. Once he saw what he had in front of him, which is basically a guy who would switch stances, but only throw from his orthodox stance. And when he was able to see those punches coming, he started to control the fight with ease. And then in the later rounds, although Haney had a small cut above his right eye, it was Kambosos who was an utter bloody mess from the offense from Haney. So Haney was able to demonstrate more things in his arsenal. Partly that's because it's the same opponent. You know, it's one thing to have 12 rounds to figure someone out, but to have 12, 13, 14, 15 rounds, an additional in the second fight, it's much easier to figure your opponent out and land more shots. But let's hope that we see more of that in the next fight. And I'm interested to see what Haney will do. He did talk. I mean, there are talks about a potential fight against Vasily Lomachenko, but as you saw from the weigh-in, it was difficult for him to make 135 pounds. Yeah. He's growing. He's a big guy. So I wonder if 140 is in his future, but it just feels like 135 just got exciting with Shakur Stevenson moving up. So we'll see. Maybe the big fights happen around 135 and 140 because Shakur could also grow into 140 as well.
Yeah, I think Shakur might have to follow those guys. You know, we're talking about Ryan Garcia, Tank, Devin Haney. I think I agree with the weight. He looked a little bit drained. He was a professional, came in, made weight, defended his titles. But yeah, just for his growth and maturity, I think his body is getting too big for that division. So we may see him at 140 sooner rather than later, whether they want to or not. Just, you know, he's getting bigger and needs to move up. And so obviously there's big matchups that could be made there as well. But I thought that, Haney did what he had to do. He handled business. And so now, you know, again, if he's going to stay at 135, people are going to, you know, be gunning for him left and right. But I think in terms of what's best for him, maybe get your feet wet at 140 and then build up to one of these bigger fights. And then, you know, Kambosos, he looked kind of drained as well at the weigh-in. I thought that, he could maybe use a change in divisions as well and move up to 140. But, there's options for him as well. I mean, monetarily speaking, if he wants to call it a day, I think he's pretty much set on that end.
Yeah, with all that money he's made, I'm not a fighter. I don't know. Maybe would I retire? Maybe. When you're a fighter, it's hard to, not want to continue fighting. But if you give me the amount of money that Kambosos just received, I'd fucking quit work today. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, he has a lovely wife. He's got kids. I mean, there's a million other things that you could do, as opposed. But he's like got that fighter spirit, that warrior spirit. So,
and he still beat Teofimo Lopez. I mean, he was undefeated going into the Devin Haney fight. You know, I mean, sometimes in boxing, we're too quick to say, oh, maybe he should retire. But on the other side of that, this is a sport where you're receiving a lot of punishment, and maybe he won't receive that kind of payday ever again. So, well, I mean, at the end of the day, you are risking your health every time you get in the ring. You are losing neurons. I mean, you're receiving punches. I mean, if the point is to make big bucks, make the big bucks and get the hell out of there. You know what I mean? If I had a son and he wanted a box, that's what I'd tell him.
Definitely. Yeah. So we'll see. Remains to be seen what each fighter is going to do. But kudos to Haney for capturing that victory again. And we'll see what happens next. Moving on to the final card that we had was a PBC on Fox pay-per-view card headlined by the return of Deontay Wilder versus sparring partner and serviceable heavyweight contender Robert Hellenius. The Nordic Nightmare is what they call him. I love that nickname. And I think Sean Porter said it about 6,000 times on the telecast last night. So, yeah, I mean, it's a cool nickname. But he headlined against Hellenius. And then we're also going to do a little hat tip mention to the co-main event between Caleb Plant and Anthony Durrell. Another one of these fights that was chock full of animosity and aggression and back and forth talk during the build-up, the press conference, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So let's start with Wilder and Hellenius, which was the main course. You know, obviously people wanted to see, you know, what does Wilder have left? Will he be that same old Wilder after sharing the ring with Tyson Fury seemingly like the last 10 years? You know, that thing's been going on forever, whether they were fighting in court or in the ring, you know, what have you. So the two names Fury and Wilder are just synonymous now. And so it's like hard to even think back, you know, before that, what was Wilder doing? Knocking Ortiz out, knocking, you know, Dominic Brazil and all these other guys out. But, you know, he was obviously a force. And it got me thinking too, when, you know, you thought Wilder was maybe going to go off into the sunset. And I think I mentioned to you, man, like I kind of miss Wilder, man. He's, you know, he's a wild guy. You know, his personality is larger than life, and just seeing him fight, you know, it just brings back a lot of those days when we were covering those early fights when he made all those defenses, man. That power is just ridiculous. And I think that's what people wanted to see. I think Jamel Herring made mention on Twitter. He's like 74-95 after what happened between Wilder and Hellenius. And someone responded, it's like, well, when you buy a Wilder pay-per-view, that's kind of what you're signing up for. And hey, we got two of them last night, two highlight reels.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I was happy with that. I was fine with that. I mean, that's what you want to see. I didn't want to see Wilder, you know, in a boxing match for six rounds. That's not his style. It's not his. And to his credit, though, he moved around a lot. He only landed three punches, and he only needed that one to take Robert Hellenius out. So it was a one-punch knockout, a fitting end for his return. And, you know, now he's back on his horse, high horse, and he's got options. You know, we're talking about Andy Ruiz, Alexander Usyk, Anthony Joshua. All of these fights are still super intriguing. I love it. You know, it doesn't matter because any other fighter other than Tyson Fury, you know, and then Deontay Wilder's number one. So I think, so, I mean, you know, you can make the argument for Usyk, but I just think if Wilder touches him or anyone else, I mean, even Fury, when he dropped Fury a bunch of times, I mean, that power is just ridiculous.
The video of Fury's back fat crossing waves when Wilder would land the right hand,
right?
Yeah. Everything about his power,
that power makes vibranium jealous. So you know, it's ridiculous. So I want to get your thoughts on what you thought of the fight, you know, the less than 3 minute fight, and you know, maybe what's next, more interestingly enough, for Deontay Wilder, now that he's gotten another knockout victory under his belt.
Less than 3 minutes and less than four punches for Deontay Wilder to come back with a knockout win. Like you mentioned, people were wondering to see how he would look after the fights against Fury. It was a career-defining trilogy. Like you said, their names are always going to be linked together forever, Fury and Wilder. But, you know, this is another stage in his career. And as you mentioned, he can still knock people out. He's still very dangerous and he's still very intelligent. He has a new trainer, Malik Scott. They were working on shortening his punches and being more compact with his offense. You can see that in the videos on YouTube and social media. He didn't really need it that much. He used some footwork, used some distance. And on that third punch that he threw, he was able to knock him out. It was a counter shot. So Wilder looked good, and you get what you pay for. We all know what we're getting when we see Deontay Wilder. We're not getting a Usyk. We're not getting a Devin Haney. We're not getting a Shakur Stevenson where he's boxing intelligently. We're getting a guy who, you know, is going to knock people out. and one of the, I guess, one of the only people who can knock people out with one shot. You know I mean, he doesn't need to set up his punches. He didn't need to throw a combination. He can wipe you out with one shot. So that's what makes Wilder exciting. And a fight against Andy Ruiz is interesting. I mean, put him in there with Anthony Joshua. There's still a lot of money to be made for Deontay Wilder in his career. So and that's aside from the Fury stuff. So it'd be interesting to see what's next for him.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see him even back against a Ruiz in December. I mean, why wait? Or if it's not Ruiz, one of these other fights, obviously not the bigger ones, not the Usyk or Joshua, but I think ideally I would like to see him Joshua early 2023. If Joshua maybe can get one under his belt and get a victory and get back on track himself. So he's coming off of two losses, obviously, against Usyk. But, you know, there's a lot of options. I mean, an Usyk fight would be great, but I still think, you know, Fury Usyk's got to be the one so that we can crown that undisputed you know, champion at heavyweight. But, you know, for Wilder, man, there's a lot of good options, and it's always going to be, yeah, he just needs that one punch, that one second.
And he's a favorite in all those potential fights. I mean, if it's not, if it's, I mean, aside from Fury and Usyk, if against Andy Ruiz, Ruiz is very vulnerable. I mean, he got caught a few times in the exchanges with Ortiz. If Wilder lands that right hand against Ruiz, it's over. With Anthony Joshua, we've seen him. We've seen that he's very vulnerable. I know that he's a big, strong fighter, but if Wilder lands that shot, it's a wrap. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So he's still a heavy favorite against anybody in the division who's not Usyk or Fury, which is, that's a compliment in my book, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, Ruiz would have a chance with his fast combinations getting in on the inside, but we've seen Wilder be able to take punches. And what happened with him is he got worn down with Fury. Obviously, he got hit with a lot of good punches, was able to take some of those. But then, you know, the thing that got to him was just being worn down by that bigger guy. Now, if Ruiz lands a couple of those fast combinations, power punches, I don't think he wipes Wilder out or knocks him out. So it's a tougher fight from that perspective because, you know, we don't know if he can apply the pressure for 12 rounds against Wilder. And like we said, you know, Wilder just needs that one little opening, that 2 second split where he's going to knock out most of these guys. So super exciting to see him back, man. It was fun. And, you know, he's got a few years left. According to him, I think they said that he wants to do 3 more years of fighting. So bring on the big ones. You know, I think he's always looking back at his defenses. I mean, he fought, you know, all the guys that were there. You know, I mean, I don't think he's ever run away from anyone. I mean, I'd still love to see fights against, you know, Dillian White. Again, we're talking about Usyk, Ruiz, you know, some of these other guys, Frank Sanchez, even. I mean, get him in there against someone. I mean, it's always going to be an exciting fight build up. And I think what he's doing with Malik Scott is awesome. And Scott is raising his profile. I think we mentioned this talking about the last Fury fight. I really like what Scott was doing with him. And even if they lost, you could see some of the things that they were applying in training and showing during their clips and things like that were being applied to the fight. And so I think for longevity's sake, you know, that helps as well. And yeah, he came out trying to move a little bit, but yeah, at the end of the day, he only needs that split second and that one hitter quitter. And speaking of one hitter quitters, our honorable hat tip and mention goes to Caleb Plant for his vicious out of the, you know, blue knockout. I mean, we've never seen him do that. Never seen Anthony Durrell folded like that either. It was a beautiful combination. I think we were talking about, I can't remember what fight it was, but it was the Navarrete fight. That liver shot, you know, when you hit a guy like that and it's that split second that they don't react and then it's just like boom, they crumble. I think that combination, Julio Cesar Chavez Sr. used to do this, where you kind of bend your knees down, you go left to the body and then come back up. I think Mike Tyson used to do that as well. But when you land that and you can do something like Caleb Plant did last night, oof, it is beautiful. So he went low with the left hook and then came back up top with the left hook and flushed right on the button. Good fight, good night. What did you think of that punch and just the overall performance?
I could always appreciate Caleb Plant's boxing skills. I really liked the fight against Uzcategui, where he won the IBF title. I like his style, the way he moves, the way he uses his lead left hand, the short left hooks. However, last night we saw something that we don't normally see, and that's him knocking people out. I think you accurately describe what happened. He went to the body first, and then he hit it to the head. I remember seeing an old video of Mike Tyson. He says, what's happening here is that you're making him think about the body shot. And while he is thinking about the body shot, you hit him with the chin shot right after, and that's what puts him out. Because as they say, it's the punch that you don't see or the punch that you don't expect that knocks you out. So he slipped to the side, short left hook to the body, and then short left hook to the chin, and he caught him right in the butt in the exchange. I think Darrell maybe had his fist up a little bit high, but it wasn't here. But when I would coach people, I would tell people, especially if you're going on the inside, you might be better served having your hand a little bit closer to the front and not right here. Because where you could get hurt is with that short left hook on the inside that comes like right here. And if your arm's not up, you're going to go down. And that's what happened with Darrell. It was a very short hook after that left hook to the body right here, right in front of where his, I believe he had his hand up where it was. And it put him out. And we've never seen that. And then, of course, he did. I don't know. It was a buried alive match at The Undertaker. But then he started doing the movement. I'm not going to repeat it. A lot of people say he's getting a lot of flack on social media because it is, you know, it's kind of a disrespectful display to do after a victory, especially after you haven't seen if your opponent is okay and he's, you know, and if the doctor has cleared him. But I mean, I don't have an opinion about it. I'm just making an observation, and the fact that it reminded me of The Undertaker.
Yeah, and I think he talked about in the post fight interview is like all that. I think all that animosity was still kind of flowing through him. You know, the things that were said to him. And he mentioned one of those things where Darrell was like, I'm not going to let this white boy beat me. You know, who are you? I don't, you know, all this stuff. And so I think that got to him, but it motivated him in the right way. It motivated him to kind of bite down and be even sharper than ever. Whereas I think Darrell was maybe buying into that aggression and animosity a little bit too much, expecting like that he was going to come out and it's just going to be a, you know, all out war. The dog was going to have to come out. And I think, yeah, some people like Dan Rafael online are like, oh, that fight sucked other than the knockout. Not for me. I thought Caleb Plant was sharp, looked the best version of himself. I mean, I like watching that stuff. And that's the thing. You know, Darrell didn't want that type of fight. Obviously, he was mocking him throughout the fight. But if you make a guy fight your fight, then things like this happen. Lulls happen. You put him to sleep. You get him to be in spots that you want him to be. And then you get to do the things that you've been working on. Obviously, he brought in a brand new trainer. A lot of people's favorite, the bread man, Steven Edwards, what they've been doing together obviously looks good, you know, in the ring for Caleb Plant. And so if a little bit more power is being mixed into the finesse and the boxing style, I like it. You know, so let's see what happens, you know, next. But I think this is the Caleb Plant. This is the type of fighter that he may be. And obviously, you know, if he ever does face David Benavidez, this is the type of fight that he's going to have to, you know, the type of game plan he's going to have to enact.
And I think a counterpuncher is only as good as his power and his pop. If you're a counterpuncher and you can't earn the respect of your opponent, then it's going to be a tough night. If he fights against David Benavidez and he makes David Benavidez aware that he has a hard left hook and he has hard counters, then he has a chance in there. Because otherwise, David Benavidez might try to walk through him. So that's the fight I want to see next. Caleb Plant versus David Benavidez. And like Canelo used to say, hey, these guys want to fight me. Why don't they fight against them between themselves first? So yeah. I want to see that fight sooner rather than later.
Well, I do like one thing that that Plant said. He's like, I got to wipe out the division and then get to Canelo. He's not like, okay, this gets me right back in the top of the front of the line for Canelo sweepstakes. He knows that's not the case. So there are some guys out there, whether it's Jermall Charlo moves up and he fights him, David Benavidez, David Morrell, there's names out there that I think would be super interesting. And oh, by the way, all those guys are PBC guys, just like Caleb Plant. So one of those fights. Yeah, no excuses. Give us one of those fights. And I think you made a good point because I think it's always been for me, like, what is Caleb Plant going to be able to do? Yeah, we know he's a high level boxer, but what is he going to be able to do to keep David Benavidez off of him? If he can do something, you know, with precision power punches in spots, you know, anyone that gets hit clean on the button has the potential of going down. And we've seen even, you know, back in the day, Ronald Gavril, who was not a big puncher, drop David Benavidez and, you know, bring offensive power to their fight. So, you know, if he continues to kind of trend up in that department and power and can keep guys off of him mixed with his athleticism and quick reflexes, I think Caleb Plant is going to be dangerous. And that second act at 168 for him is going to be, you know, a really good one for him.
Oh yeah. And maybe Darrell underestimated Plant's power. I think that's, yeah, I don't care. He's a grown man. He's been training his whole life. Never underestimate someone's power.
Definitely. So to recap, we got a bunch of good knockouts. We got some high level boxing. So another great weekend for boxing. And we're glad to be back here at the RBR Recap. We'll be back next week with episode 32.
Thank you for listening to the RBR Recap. Make sure to follow us on social media at RBR Recap and visit RBRRecap.com for the latest episodes.